of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the century of lies. Hello, my friends. Welcome to this edition of Century of Lies. I just returned from a trip to Hartford, Connecticut, to observe the Illicit Drugs Burden and Policy Conference. It was presented by the City of Hartford, hosted by Trinity College, and was sponsored by Aetna Insurance Foundation. The mayor of Hartford, the police chief, health officials, the DEA, and many members of reform organizations were in attendance and speaking over the two-day session. The Drug Truth Network will be providing additional coverage of this conference over the next several days, but for this program I wanted to focus on one speech that many have called the best ever given for ending drug prohibition. The speaker finds himself free at last to speak truth directly to power. So please forgive the enthusiasm. This is the head of the Criminal Justice Policy Foundation, CJPF.org, Mr. Eric Sterling.
I'd like to first begin with just a sort of a show of hands. How many people here live in Hartford? Could you raise your hand? Okay. And how many of you are business leaders? You have a business in Hartford. Could you raise your hand if you're involved in business in Hartford? I see a couple hands. How many of you depend upon the vitality of Hartford's economy for your life and for the quality of life here? Raise your hand. Good, everybody, just about everybody. Let me ask, how many people here are police officers engaged in law enforcement? Raise your hand. Number of gentlemen here. How many of you are work in the health fields? Raise your hand. Lots of people. Very excellent. Are there any gang members in the audience? I don't know why that's funny. I mean, in other words, if we were to have a conference, let's say, on the problem of American Indians, and we didn't invite any Indians, we didn't have any Indians at the conference, we'd say, well, you know, where are the Indians? Are there any drug users in the audience? I see a number of hands. Good. Because to not have a conference about drug users and not have drug users in the audience is preposterous. And it's very rare that we find conferences like this, and I commend the organizers to set up a conference which people who are drug users feel comfortable to come and talk. Because usually, as we heard earlier in the first presentation, they are stigmatized. Any street outreach workers here? Any people who work in the street? Excellent. Number of hands. Very good. Any people who define themselves as community activists? Excellent. Excellent. Two hands over there. The title of my talk, is about the Camden experience. And the only reason that I picked Camden is that when I was in college and law school, Camden was our regional Hartford. Camden was, to quote the New York Times of last December, a classic model of urban despair for decades. And Hartford has, in some respect, been that kind of model. And recently, a lieutenant in the police department, they're talking about the struggling economic recovery, Camden trying to be the rising star of South Jersey, one might say, struggles with the kinds of crime and violence that we just had described in the presentation today. And a quote from the New York Times of last December, the dream of Renaissance is being interrupted by a brutal reality, and at the cusp of a supposed economic recovery, the most thriving trade remains crack cocaine. How many of you would say that drugs are one of the biggest industries in the city of Hartford? Raise your hand. Yeah, and that's not a surprise, because in fact, drugs is one of the biggest industries in the United States. It's a $65 billion a year retail industry, according to the data that the White House Drug Czar's Office compiled, which would make it about, if it were all in one industry, the 15th largest company on the Fortune 500. When we think about what we're trying to do in drug policy, we heard Chief Harnett talk about, the taking out the gangs, the street corner dealers. I suggest when we think about drug policy, it ought to be part of a comprehensive policy that says our goal is a safe and healthy society, a safe and healthy community. That's what we want. We want safety and health for our children. That's what we want. And any policy that's inconsistent with that, or that undermines that, has to be changed. And the problem with the war on drugs, the problem with drug enforcement, the problem with drug prohibition is it makes more crime and creates more ill health. I was at a ward dinner at the National Press Club Wednesday night, in which Barrios Unidos, an anti-gang organization that exists in the West, where gang members from the Hispanic gangs, the Mexican gangs, the black gangs, the prison gangs, are being recruited out of the gangs to give up La Vida Loca, to give up the violence and the drugs by former gang members. And as I was talking to them, I was, hey, that's me. I used to belong to the cop gang. I was a colonel in the war on drugs. I know all the former DEA heads. I've had dinner with Asa Hutchison. I wrote the drug laws. I worked with the House Narcotics Committee. I've been to Colombia and see them chop down, you know, the cannabis plants. I gave DEA more power to go after drug traffickers and more money and to lock people up. And I now realize, like the members of the gangs, that doesn't work. That's a crazy life. It's a crazy life. Because the war on drugs is built on utterly illogical premises. Not that drugs are bad. We can concede that drugs are harmful, although they're not cancer the way the mayor called it. I mean, that I used to write those speeches. Drugs are cancer. Crack is cancer. I mean, this is a rhetoric that has been repeated now for about 100 years in our society. But the illogical part is our objective of drug enforcement is to continually raise the price of drugs through prohibition. Raising the price has one economic rule. More people go into the business. The higher the price, the greater the profit. The greater the profit, the more people are drawn into it. Let us remember the gold rush of 1849 in California, or the gold rush in Alaska. You know, men in Hartford in 1849 took off their aprons at a hardware store, picked up a shovel, and went to California to make their fortune. And today, the crack business is where you can make your fortune. The heroin business is where you can make your fortune. The role of the war on drugs drives up the price. And that, it's like the hot air over the Gulf of Mexico. It naturally rises. You can't stop it. So people go into the drug business because of drug enforcement. Is that clear? Is everybody following me here? This is economics 101. The war on drugs makes no sense economically. Here's the second point. Because we, through drug enforcement, raise the price of a pure gram of cocaine probably sells in this city for between $100 and $150. Is that correct, gentlemen? And what does the price of a pure gram of heroin sell for in the city of heroin? Maybe a couple thousand dollars? In that range. And the price of marijuana in the city, what does that sell for? Maybe $13 to $15 a gram? And what is the price of gold today? $13.50 a gram. Well, what a kind of business you want to go into. Now, the thing about that very valuable product, heroin, cocaine, it's sold for cash only. I can't buy it with a check and a couple pieces of identification or a credit card. It's cash only. So if I'm in the drug business, what do I need? I need security. And the chief told us, who's the guy on the corner? The guy with the biggest gun, the toughest guy. The drug business must be violent. If I have a drug location, I can't hire off-duty police officers to protect it. I can't hire Wackenhut. I can't hire Wells. I need the guy with the biggest gun, the most dangerous outlaw, the guy whose reputation is on the street as a crazy-ass killer. That's who I want. So that me, my receipts, my customers, my inventory are left alone. That's the rule. I need violence. I need the threat of violence every place where I've got drugs worth $1,000 a gram or $100 a gram, because I don't have the security system that the jewelry store has. I don't have, you know, this. I don't have that. I can't have that. I need guns. Now, the second thing about this crazy business of what we call controlled substances, the most out-of-control substances in the entire economy, and it's parenthetically, controlled substances are the biggest oxymoron. There's nothing more uncontrolled than the controlled substances. The other thing is that in this business, like a $65 billion a year business, like every other business, the conflicts that exist need to be resolved. Can I sue you in circuit court or superior court when you breach the contract and sell me baking soda instead of crack? How do I enforce my disagreements when you said you were going to deliver it and you never showed up? How do I enforce a covenant not to compete when this guy who's been working for me takes my customers away from me? Can I sue him? He takes, you know, he cuts me out of the deal. Pays a little more to my supplier. I sue him, right? All right, go to arbitration. Call in a mediator. I don't think so. I take out my guns. That's the only way I can resolve the conflict in this business is through violence. There is no other way. So this, let's understand. Drug prohibition equals violence, equals crime, expensive drugs. Now, those of us who are drug users in the room know that drugs are more expensive, and therefore more of our money goes into it. If I have a compulsive drug habit, if I'm one of the fraction of the population in the city who uses heroin or cocaine, I can't afford my habit on my salary. I quickly exhaust my savings. I pawn what I've got, and then I start selling myself, and then I start using other people's money. I steal it. That's inevitable when the drugs are in an exaggerated price. Now, cocaine, $100 a gram. What does sugar cost per gram? Sugar, white sugar, refined white powder grown from a tropical plant. And we import millions of metric tons of sugar every year. Sugar costs a few cents a gram, a fraction of a cent a gram. And cocaine costs $100 a gram. It's not hard to process cocaine. It's not particularly expensive. Cocaine is only expensive because of prohibition and drug enforcement. Quick, show of hands. War on drugs, successful policy, raise your hand. War on drugs, failing policy to protect public health and safety, raise your hands. Consensus on that point, why does the failure continue? The failure continues for a number of reasons. Number one, tradition. Chief Arnett, he tells us about his white hair. He's been doing this for a long time. He's been telling us, what he told you today is not anything I haven't heard in 25 years in Washington with chiefs of police coming to testify before my subcommittees, with DEA testifying before me. He didn't tell me anything I hadn't heard before. He didn't tell me anything that I hadn't heard before. He does not have a new strategy, and his strategy is not going to be any more successful. Call it neighborhood policing. Let's put up a new sign. Let's put up a new PowerPoint. Call it neighborhood. Let's call it community policing. Let's call it street sweeping. Call it what you will. It's not going to be any kind of a change. But tradition, and we listen to cops. And part of the problem is we, of course, misclassified the problem. There's a crime. Crime and drugs goes together like peanut butter and jelly. Crime and drugs. Peanut butter and jelly. Crime and drugs. Drugs and crime. Crime and drugs. It is, of course, not fundamentally a crime problem for the addicts. It's fundamentally a tragic social, economic, spiritual health problem. And so, we have, who's our leader speaker? The chief police. Where's the minister? Where's the doctor? Where's the public health commissioner? Those are the people who ought to be framing the problem. They frame the problem, but we turn to the cops because, hey, crime and drugs. We've misclassified the problem. Congress did it with the Harrison Narcotics Act. We did it again in marijuana. We have misidentified this. So, what do we do? Crime problem. Drug users are wrong. We hear drug offenses. We talk about drug crime. The drug users, they're not any different than us. drug czar Barry McAfee used to say, 3/4 of America's drug users worked. Go to the job. That's correct. They are people just like us. Now, there is a fraction of drug users that we see on television. They're usually black or Hispanic. And we think of the drug problem as an urban problem. Black, Hispanic. When I talk to white audiences and I make the point that youth at risk are their white kids, not the black kids, what are you talking about? We all know youth at risk means black kid. Youth at risk means Hispanic kid, because they're the ones who use drugs. The data that the White House publishes, but nobody bothers to read, is white high school kids are 4 times more likely to be using cocaine than black high school kids, than their peers. Not 40% higher, 400% higher. Now, it happens that they use marijuana about the same. 2 things here. One, marijuana can't be a gateway drug only for white kids. I mean, it's not, it's either a gateway drug or it's not. Second thing, black culture has a way to inoculate their youth against the use of harder drugs that white culture is not really not interested in. Because whites know we don't have anything to learn from blacks except rap and basketball tricks. How to deal with drugs? Don't go to the black community. They've got the problem. Now, the thing here is to understand the real reason I think the war on drugs continues, because it fails to protect public health. It fails to stop crime. It fails to even hurt the drug traffickers. Let me say that for just a moment. I told you about the price of cocaine and heroin. The price of cocaine and heroin has been going down steadily for the last 25 years. And the quality delivered on the street has been going up steadily. The curve of the intersecting curves of price and performance look like the price and performance of objects like this, or DVD players, or laptops. I get a better and better cell phone for less and less money. I get a better and better computer for less and less money. I get better and better cocaine for less and less money. That's wrong. That doesn't make sense. That's the war on drugs in action. Because drug enforcement is what improves the criminal drug market. Drug dealers advertise. You see them on television. Is there a Consumer Reports magazine that tells you about the quality of the different brands? Can you go to the Yellow Pages and find cocaine dealer and sort of call and compare prices? Drug enforcement weeds out the stupid dope dealers, the inefficient dope dealers, the low-hanging fruit dope dealers. That's what drug enforcement does best. They do the easy cases. The U.S. Department of Justice, 70% of all the federal cocaine convictions are against, according to the Sentencing Commission, the lowest level people, unloaders, lookouts, touts, street level dealers. That's the U.S. Justice Department, and only 7% are managers, high-level dealers, importers. That's the U.S. Justice Department. And if they're not doing the job, nobody is. The real reason the war on drugs continues is it is very successful as the replacement of legal segregation. Think about this for a moment. Throughout the 20th century, segregation was the law. You had Plessy versus Ferguson in 1896. You had, at the very time that we're passing the Harris and Narcotics Act in 1914, is the rise of the Ku Klux Klan. Woodrow Wilson comes to become president of the United States. One of his first acts as president is to order the segregation of federal lunchrooms in federal buildings in Washington. We look back and we forget our history. But racism and the war on drugs are in the same cradle. They are in the same cradle. And throughout the growth of this, the Marijuana Tax Act was about making sure that white Okies in California could get agricultural jobs that had been held for centuries by the Hispanics in California. The change economic opportunity. And in the 1960s, look at this. The 1950s and 60s, civil rights movement in what we all remember was an incredibly bloody struggle of against white resistance to change. Wins! Now, what happened to that white resistance? What happened to all of the institutions that maintained white privilege? They just evaporated? The law maintained segregation. When the black kid went into the white-only area, the local cops came and kicked him out. When blacks tried to move into the white neighborhoods, they were sued in the courts, and the courts would say, I'm sorry, we've got this racial covenant in the deed. You can't buy that property. It says so in the deed. No blacks. So the civil rights movement wins in the 1960s. Segregation is outlawed. Now, segregation is was a status kind of like being on parole today. You can't go here, you can't do that, you can't associate with these people. Segregation is like parole. So we substituted a new kind of parole. President Nixon says to Haldeman, according to Haldeman's diaries, this is a problem really about the blacks, but we can't say it. In the 1960s, when we had black GIs coming back from Vietnam, who supposedly were all addicted to heroin, but trained in the use of, you know, semi-automatic weapons, the great fear was, you know, that black ex-GIs are going to run rampant in a crime wave in our cities. Have to lock them up. Need to bring out the cops. So we create the DEA. We pass the Controlled Substances Act. And since then, I mean, here's the thing. Here's the data. From 1930 to 1970, the rate of incarceration in the United States was level at about 110 per 100,000. The rate at which people were in prison from alcohol prohibition, through the Depression, through World War II, through the World War II post-war boom, through the 50s, through the 60s, right up to 1970, the rate of incarceration is roughly level at 110 per 100,000. And at that point, with the end of legal segregation, the rate of incarceration takes off like a missile and is now 700 per 100,000. And it's overwhelmingly black. And it is about the war on drugs. The war on drugs says to America, blacks use drugs. Blacks are criminals. Blacks are dangerous. Poor blacks, poor people who want to go to college but have a drug conviction, don't get a loan. You can have a rape conviction. You can get a federal student loan. They don't care about that. You can have a sexual assault, of any kind of crime but drugs. Drugs, special category, you'll get a federal student loan. Now, according to the FBI last week, we have arrested 2 million juveniles for drug offenses in the last 10 years. And they're mostly, of course, I mean, remember, rich kids don't need college loans. Poor people need college loans. Public housing. Drug offense. You get you, not just you, but your grandma gets kicked out of public housing. And the Supreme Court says that's okay in Rucker versus Oakland. That's okay. Food stamps. You're desperately poor. You need food stamps. If you have a felony conviction, you have a lifetime ban under federal law, under the 1996 Welfare Reform Act. A lifetime ban from getting food stamps for your hungry kid. This is, now, it's not a life, it's not a felony conviction for murder, rape, ripping on. It's a life sentence, it's a lifetime ban for a drug felony. Get the picture? So here's the thing. We have this prohibition. There's no question about it. We need a system of control. Control? We want the law involved. Law? That means legalization. Now, does that mean we sell crack cocaine here in the cafeteria next to the Coca-Cola? I don't think so. We have a genius for regulation. There is nothing in our lives that is not regulated and controlled. And they're regulated differently. The way in which the clothing we're wearing is regulated differently than the way the tablecloths are regulated. The way in which certain, you know, that's the thing, is all the drugs don't have to be regulated one way. That's, of course, the current way. That's the stupid way. No, prohibition. It's all legal. So here's our challenge. Our challenge is, as we think about this problem, to recognize it is complex. It has been misclassified. And we desperately need to abandon, you'll pardon me, the bullshit that has dominated the way we've thought about this problem for too long. Because I used to write that bullshit for members of Congress, and I can't take it anymore. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very, very much.
Okay, once again, that was Mr. Eric Sterling of the Criminal Justice Policy Foundation, CJPF.org. And by the way, there were about 150 people at the conference when Eric gave his speech, and that laugh you heard most predominantly was a black superior court judge, Judge Arthur Burnett of the National African American Drug Policy Coalition, and a Washington, D.C. superior court judge. The Drug Truth Network will be covering the judge's speech, as well as many of the other attendees, and I'll list them. Robert Painter, a surgeon. He's the minority leader of the city of Hartford and one of the organizers of the event. Eddie Perez, the mayor of Hartford. Marilda Gandara, president of the Aetna Foundation. Ronald Joyce, the vice president of Trinity College. Patrick Harnett, chief of police of Hartford. Ivan Kuznick, consultant, U.S. Department of Justice. Roger Goodman of the King County Bar Association. Richard Burton, NAACP. Mark Kaczynski, DEA agent. James Thomas, State's Attorney's Office. Jack Cole of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. Merrill Singer, Executive Director of the Hispanic Health Council. Barbara Fair, People Against Injustice. Teresa Lance, Department of Corrections. Judge Jorge Simon. Dr. Dale Geringer of California Normal. Cliff Thornton of efficacy-online.org. Nick I of Reconsider Magazine. Robin Anderson, Hartford Youth Project. Dr. J. Hughes, Trinity College. Robert Helmer, Yale University. Scarlett Swerdlow, Executive Director of Students for a Sensible Drug Policy. And several others will be included in our subsequent programs. Something that should be noted, among all the speakers, among all the attendees, there was a unanimous voice calling for change in our drug war policy. Whether we're talking about the DEA agent, the police chief, the mayor, the health officials, anybody who attended, we all agree that the upside to the drug war is pretty far down. For the programmers listening to the show, I'd like to advise you to go to our new website, endprohibition.org. There's a link available to take you to the rough audio and descriptions of the speakers at this event. Now to add a little bit of normalcy to the Century of Lies program. Identify this jurisdiction by its drug laws. For nearly a century, this nation was demonized for the mistreatment of its citizens. Now their citizens in possession of small amounts of drugs face no jail time. Their president presented a package of new laws to their legislature, where distinctions are made between large-scale traffickers and users and small-time dealers. Possession of up to 10 times the average single dose of a controlled substance is no longer considered a criminal offense. Enjoying the freedom to select what medicines they choose to put into their bodies are the citizens, current and former communists, terrorists, and threats to world domination. Drugs are basically legal thanks to President Putin and the Duma of Russia. Quick note, I want to welcome to the Drug Truth Network WFCS up in Central Connecticut State University. Besides more reports from the Hartford Conference in the coming weeks, I'll be giving you stories from the Wonders of Cannabis event, the Drug Policy Alliance Conference, and then we'll be reporting from Vancouver as well as Seattle and their conference titled The Exit Strategy from the War on Drugs. And please remember that there is no trust, no truth, no justice, no logic, no scientific fact, no medical data, no moral reason, no religious underpinnings. In fact, no reason whatsoever for the drug war to continue. We've been duped. The drug lords run both sides of this equation. Please do your part to help bring it to an end. Prohibido istak ivalesco. For the Drug Truth Network, this is Dean Becker asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. The show produced at the Pacifica Studios of KPFT, Houston. Our engineer, Philip Duffy.